Welcome, everyone. My name is Dr. Rasa, and I would like to do a short introduction for Anutam, because some of you might not know much about her. So Anutam lives in Chennai, India, and she serves as a counseling psychologist who's trained in multiple modalities of counseling. She's worked as an assistant professor of psychology for 2 years, and she has trained counseling interns to offer therapy and psychological help. She has been offering therapeutic help online for the last 4 years, and she's currently undergoing training in psychotherapy in a therapy approach called transactional analysis. So I have not yet had the pleasure of meeting Anutam in 3D, but I have met her many times online. And one of the many things that I appreciate about her is her willingness to be moved by wonder. If you ever watch Anutam's face when she hears something, she just like lights up and her eyes the size of Lord Jagannath, and her smile becomes so huge. And she's just really willing to be moved by that. And for me, this it kind of poises her in a position for continual learning. So I really appreciate that about you, Anutam, and I'm really looking forward to what you can share with us today, what will come forward. So on that note, I will turn it over to you.
Yes. Thank you so much for introducing me, Bhakti Rasa. I am in wonder seeing the qualities that you have noted in me. That's a surprise for me. Thank you. We'll start with the session. I'll start with Mangalacharan. Om ज्ञानतिमिरान्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनाशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः नमो ॐ विष्णुपादाय कृष्णपृष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्त स्वामीनिति नामिने नमस्ते सारस्वते देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेषा शून्यवादी पाश्चात्यदेशतारिणे जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासदि गौर भक्त वृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे यस सो आई विल स्टार्ट विथ शेयरिंग माय स्क्रीन Is my screen visible? Actually, since I have my screen in front of me, if someone can unmute and let me know.
Yes,
is it
we
visible?
see it. Yes. Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. So Hare Krishna. So the topic that we are dealing with today is a very important and of course a sensitive topic, which is shame. So before we begin, I would like to put a disclaimer that because the topic itself is sensitive, there might be certain sensitive themes that I might touch on. Sometimes to give examples, I might share some cases from my own clients. Of course, maintaining anonymity, I would not reveal all details. And some of those themes may touch on abuse or suicidal ideations. So in case if any of these themes are triggering for you, I would invite you to use your discretion in proceeding with caution. Yes, on that note, I'll start with a reflection question. So what is shame according to you? What does shame mean to you? Take a moment, reflect on that. What does shame mean to you? So I would like you to sit with what your understanding of shame is. And as we unpack shame in this session, see how you are able to relate with shame in that context. See if you are able to compare it and connect with that. Yes. So what is shame? So shame is a social emotion. So it is not something we experience when we are in the comforts of our room or when we are listening to something or when we are doing something personally. That is usually not when we experience shame. Shame is experienced when we are amidst people, when we are confronted by them, when we have to face them. So it's in a social setting where a person experiences shame. And when do they experience shame? When there is an actual loss of dignity or when there is a perceived loss of dignity. If, for example, somebody is openly judging you in front of you. So what's happening is they are disrespecting you. So there's a loss of dignity there. Sometimes someone might be giving me a feedback, a constructive feedback, which could be critical. But then if I am someone who's shame sensitive, then I might perceive that as being embarrassing, humiliating. And at that point, that could be a perceived loss of dignity. So the term shame is synonymous with words like embarrassment, humiliation, disregard, disrespect, awkwardness, feeling insulted. So these are all synonymous with shame. And shame can pertain. So what is happening in shame is there is a devaluation of self. So I'm losing my worth or value in evaluating myself. So it's a self-evaluative emotion where I evaluate myself to be unworthy or not valuable. Yeah. So shame can pertain to many domains. So sometimes shame can be surrounding body, physical appearance. Shame can be surrounding a behavior. So for example, wondering, why did I do this? I should not have said that in front of such and such person. So that I'm feeling embarrassed about it. So it can be a shameful behavior, like failing in competition, saying something which I feel could be stupid or doing something wrong. Now, shame has two sister feelings. So shame and its corollary. So when we are experiencing shame, I'm not experiencing shame in isolation. It is accompanied with two of its best friends. So they are guilt and regret. So guilt is an emotion we experience when there is an when I feel that I've crossed my moral, I have violated my moral compass. So perception of transgressed rules of morality. That is when guilt is experienced. Sorry, I said it is shame, right? Yeah, guilt is experienced when I feel that I have violated my moral compass. It's a sense of my conscience feeling pricked. That is guilt. Guilt can also be defined as anger towards self. Yeah. And regret is an emotion we experience when there is a remorse over a choice that I've made in the past. I wish I had not done what I did in the past in a given situation. For example, taking, let's say somebody is doing a presentation in front of a huge audience. They are standing on the stage and doing a presentation. And after the presentation, they are receiving feedback, both positive and negative. Now, if the person is perceiving the negative feedback in, let's say, a shame-provoking manner, they are shame-sensitive, what happens is not only are they feeling embarrassed and awkward there, they may also be feeling guilty about making the mistake that was pointed out. They may also be feeling guilty about how can I stand here when I was not prepared? I should have been prepared for whatever questions were to come. I should have foreseen, you know, whatever feedback I might have received, negative feedback I might have received, I should have foreseen that and incorporated that. So there is guilt, and then there could be regrets in terms of maybe I should not have chosen to present. So that makes shame, the experience of shame, even more painful because there is guilt and regrets along with it. And when a person is caught in the loop of these three emotions, then it can become self-sabotaging. So they may engage in overthinking. There could be destructive criticism of self. They may withdraw from their surroundings because being amongst people can feel too painful. And then people who are struggling with toxic shame may also perceive that they are undeserving of any respect or any appreciation. So they may reject any appreciation or respect they may be receiving. For example, even in this case of presentation, if somebody is offering, if the feedback is wholesome, it has positive and negative feedbacks, a person may sort of filter out the positive feedbacks and then choose to perceive only the negative feedback because that validates their belief that I am unworthy of respect or appreciation. Yeah. Roots of shame. So happen by itself. Studies conducted within this, that is what most of the research studies would say. So we are not aware of the past life samskaras, but my hypothesis is that could also be playing an important role in shame or other dysfunctional emotions for that matter, the anarthas, which we may also be referring to as anarthas. Yes. So roots of shame. How does shame begin? Where does it all come from? So, when the child is being vulnerable, when an infant or a toddler is being their authentic self, is expressing a particular need, and at that point the parent is rejecting the child. So, what happens is the rejection feels too humiliating for the child. It's too painful for the child to handle. So at that point, the child realizes that they are not accepted for who they are. So rejection of authentic self by primary caregivers, not just parents, anybody who's taking care of the child. The next root cause could be abuse of any forms. So if a person has undergone physical, verbal, psychological, sexual abuse or neglect, any of these forms of abuse are quite dehumanizing. You're not seeing the person as a person. You might be treating them as an object or an instrument, something that can be taken advantage of, taken for granted, exploited. So that is also quite degrading, you know. So at that point, shame can emerge. So one of my client cases that I could share here is so she's someone who throughout her childhood had been criticized by her father quite frequently, especially in areas of academics and in terms of how she performs and also with regard to how she interacts with her family members. As a result of which, what happened is that she's in her late 20s now, and she's struggling to interact with people. She's struggling to form close bonds. Even in office also, she's struggling to seek help from her colleagues because she's too ashamed to face people. She fears being criticized, or she fears being you know, told that she's not good enough. So it's triggering that instinctive sense of rejection by the parent. So the whatever is happening in the here and now, that is sort of triggering a childhood memory of being criticized as being not good enough by her father. So it is too painful for her. As a result of which, what she does is she chooses to withdraw. She chooses to handle things by herself. And sometimes that results in addictive behaviors as well. And all of these are manifestations or expressions of shame, rather twisted expressions of shame. Yes. So that way, abuse can also be dysfunctional, childhood abuse. And then the last is when the developmental needs of the child are not met. So in each stage, as we grow up, we have certain developmental needs. So till 9 months of age, an infant's developmental need is trust versus mistrust. So when the child is in need, they may cry, and any need, they only cry. They don't have the cognition or the language to communicate their needs. So the more the parent is attuned to the needs of the child learns to trust the primary caregiver. So at that stage, when trust is established with the primary caregiver, what happens is that developmental need is met. However, if let's say when the infant is crying, the primary caregiver gets annoyed, or is scolding the child, or is neglecting. So what happens is the child develops a sense of mistrust. And similarly, growing up in the teen age, the need of a teen is identity versus role confusion. So to form a sense of who I am, a sense of self-concept, is very crucial in teenage. So that's one of the reasons why teens step away from parents. They step into the larger world. In they are more involved with their peer circle because somehow peers help them, set or define who they are in one sense. So when a healthy sense of identity is formed, then that developmental need is met. But when it is not formed, then it can lead to role confusion, confusion about who am I. There can be aspects of self they may be in denial of, aspects of self they may be dissatisfied with. So there is a psychologist named Erik Erikson. So if you would like to know more about developmental needs, you can probably refer to his. So he has proposed a theory known as psychosocial stages of development. So where he mentions the age groups and the corresponding developmental needs. Yes. So now from Shastras, we have an account of shame, childhood shame. So that is the historical account of Dhruva Maharaj and his stepmother. So we can see how shame is very painful. So I'll just read through that pastime. Once upon a time, King Uttanapada was patting the son of Suruchi, Uttama, placing him on his lap. Dhruva Maharaj was also trying to get on the king's lap, but the king did not very much welcome him. While the child Dhruva Maharaj was trying to get on the lap of his father, Suruchi, his stepmother, became very envious of the child, and with great pride, she began to speak so as to be heard by the king himself. Queen Suruchi told Dhruva Maharaj, "My dear child, you do not deserve to sit on the throne or on the lap of the king. Surely you are also the son of the king, but because you did not take your birth from my womb, you are not qualified to sit on your father's lap. My dear child, you are unaware that you were born not of my womb, but of another woman." So we can see how she's completely bringing down the dignity of Dhruva Maharaj's mother as just an other woman. Therefore, you should know that your attempt is doomed to failure. You're trying to fulfill a desire which is impossible to fulfill. So all that the child Dhruva was doing was trying to seek love and belongingness needs from his father. But we can see how the father was also neglectful and how his stepmother very painfully abused and rejected the child. Now, what impact did it have on Dhruva Maharaj? So the impact is when Dhruva Maharaj, when he saw that his father was silent and did not protest, he immediately left the palace and went to his mother. When Dhruva Maharaj reached his mother, his lips were trembling in anger and he was crying very grievously. So these are some of the signs of shame, anger, crying, And we do know that how after this pastime, somehow by the intervention of his mother, Narad Muni, and subsequently by darshan of the Lord himself, the sweet Lord, we can see how Dhruva's wounded heart found its healing and joy. He realized that he was placing worth on things which were not worthy, and he was losing his sight of what was actually worthy. So we see how he differentiates shards of glasses and diamond. Yeah. So the next is, So the pattern of attachment children have with their primary caregivers, it determines the degree of security, the degree of trust, or a healthy sense of self-esteem felt by the child. So now researches on infants. So researches on infants indicate that shame actually also has biological antecedents. That is, it has biological factors involved. It's not just emotional, or it's not just cognitive and behavioral, it's also biological. So the example given is when a mother fails to respond to a child's giggle, or when the child is smiling, or when the child is gazing. So when they fail to respond, then what happens is they have observed that the infant reacts to that failure to respond through slumping of shoulders, lowered gaze, and then the neuronal stimulation was also found to be low. So there is a physiological letdown which the child is experiencing, and the child can, because the child is instinctive at that age. Infants are usually instinctive, they function on instincts. So when there's a physiological letdown, the child may view that as its own fault, something that the baby did, which caused the mother's lack of responsiveness. So the baby would somehow attribute mother's actions, or rather inaction, to its own self. So that's how the very infantile shame is at a very rudimentary level is developed. And the next is, children also have an egocentric pattern of cognition. So egocentric is where they feel that the world revolves around them in one sense. So which means that they see anything that is happening around them, they are naturally the cause of it. Now, of course, egocentric pattern of cognition is very much a part of a developmental process. All of us have been there, and it is essential part of the developmental process. But what happens is this makes the child vulnerable to personalizing oneself as being the cause of abuse, or the unpleasant experience, which can be abuse of any sorts. And thereby, because I am the cause of the unpleasant experiences that others are putting me through, therefore the child would end up attributing it to feelings of feeling that they are unworthy of love, unworthy of belonging, respect, acceptance, joy, growth, or sometimes even in extreme cases, feeling unworthy of existing. So to that extent, they feel dehumanized. And then they may develop a false or an unhealthy sense of self in response to rejection of their authentic self. So again, to share a client example here. So there's this one client, again, she is in her early 30s. And as a child, her father was working, and her mother was also working. But then, at least in the case of father, when he was at home, he would be involved with the lives of the children, and whatever limited time he used to spend with them. However, the mother was a little awkward around her children, as a result of which, she did not feel very connected with her mother from the beginning. And a lot of times, the mother was also ridden with so much guilt. She would compare especially when the child when the client was a child, she would compare the client with other peers of her age and tell them that you should teach her to be like you, as good as you. So what the mother is secretly implying here, or unconsciously implying here, is that the child is not good enough. She's not satisfied with how the child is performing academically or how the child is as a person. And of course, emotionally also there was neglect involved. And in one such occasion, when her mother was out, usually there is a helper, a worker who would visit their house to clean the house. And they had been coming regularly to clean the house. Every evenings they would come. So at that time, only the client and her sister were there at home. And in one such occasion, this helper happens to be a man, a young adult. And turns out that he slowly started grooming them, and then there were instances of sexual molestation. And the client, in order to protect her younger sister, she had to place her in another room, give her some other engagement so that she is protected. So it's like she's sacrificing her well-being to protect her own sister. And in the here and now, there are moments where client reported thinking that, I'm genuinely wondering if only I didn't exist, would it make any difference to people around me? Would it matter? And it was quite painful to hear how, on some level, people feel that they're unworthy of existing. And she was also struggling with trusting even her significant other. So she has a partner, and somehow she could not bring herself to speak about her childhood abuse and neglect to him. And of course, we had, in the process of unpacking and working with the abuse, she was somehow able to bring herself to trust and then gradually communicate that. And in communicating, she realized that the partner was also accepting and empathic. So that is one of the impacts shame has. It sort of disables a person's ability to trust people around or to form secure relationships. Yes. So that takes us to the next topic, which is impact of shame. Yes. So the early childhood experiences, it greatly shapes a person's inner world. So how a person perceives the here and now, it's through the filters they have developed from their childhood. So the negative childhood experiences becomes the filters through which the person would perceive themselves, they would perceive others, and they would perceive life or world at large. Now, these filters can also be referred to as core beliefs, and these core beliefs become unconscious. That is, at some point, they're not even aware that, these core beliefs are activating these dysfunctional forms of thinking, feeling, and behaving or relating with the world. Thus, these core beliefs, it distorts some of the natural traits which a child has, and these traits are wonderful in its own ways. And there is an author named John Bradshaw, and he uses the term wonderful to describe the natural traits of a child, which naturally occurs in a child, but somehow in course of time with unpleasant experiences, those traits are either inhibited, disabled, disconnected, or they get distorted. That is, they are expressed in unhealthy or dysfunctional ways. Yes. So the first quality is wonder. Just give me a minute. Yeah. So wonder is a child's ability to be curious, explore their world, take risks. And for an infant or for a child, it is this curiosity that leads them to discovery. And a lot of times they find their discoveries very amusing. So wonder and curiosity both are very important for normal growth and development. And these are the childlike qualities which even now we are it would be nice if we can have these qualities because many scientists, poets, artists, philosophers, they're all filled with childlike wonder and curiosity about the mysteries, mysteries which lie beyond the mysteries of the world. So when this quality of wonder or curiosity is inhibited, what happens is the child would start playing it safe. They would avoid taking any healthy and calculated risks, and that would also result, that would also get, exhibited even in the adult forms of coping. So even as an adult, they would play it safe. They would rather fit in than, think creatively, use creativity, use novelty. They would not prefer thinking out of the box because the qualities of wonder and curiosity are disabled in one sense. Yes. So the next quality is optimism. So optimism again is a natural state for a child. They are able to have faith in their primary caregivers. That's why they are vulnerable and they naturally believe and trust whatever the caregiver tells them. And children also naturally believe that the world is friendly. That's why they don't have the conception of pain. Like they may, jump from, try to attempt jumping from a sofa down to the floor. So of course, as adults, it becomes our responsibility to make the environment child safe. But then as a child, they don't have this sense of pessimism. It's like they believe that everything around them, there is goodness in it. And it's again instinctive on some level. So this is also referred to as a childlike faith. So when a child is abused or shamed, their openness and their ability to trust, both of them are deadened. So the bond that allows them to trust and move forward optimistically, that is cut. So the child learns to become very vigilant, anxious as a result of being pessimistic. I'm negative about how I perceive you, so I'm not able to trust you. So optimism for intimacy to happen, optimism and trust, they are the soul of intimacy. So we need to risk being vulnerable if we want to be intimate. But for me to risk being vulnerable, I need to be optimistic that you will hold space for me to be vulnerable. People around me will be empathic, they will hold space. But then when that optimism is not there, then they'll struggle taking the risk of being vulnerable. And to sort of integrate optimism in context of bhakti, because again we see that the material world is seen as a combination of good or bad, good and bad, and the good is temporary. So it may seem again the notion of the nature of material world may seem as if it's all bad in one sense. But then how I would put optimism in context of that is believing in the greater good beyond the temporary good and bad. So the greater good is the sweet absolute. So in instances of many devotees, even cases like Queen Kunti and other surrendered souls, we see how they joyfully move forward to the flute call, like how Maharaj puts it, because they believe in that sense of optimism, a very universal, a global sense of optimism. By the end of the day, for a devotee, all they see is the Lord and his energies. So in one sense, it's all good for them. So we are invited to step into that state of optimism, even in our own devotional journeys. Yes, so we are not making it toxic positivity. Again, I'm aware of that term. So by optimism, what I mean here is you're acknowledging the good and the bad here, but then you're choosing to see that beyond the good and bad, there is also, the greater good. So in our own sustainable ways, we navigate between the temporary good and bad. And in sustainable ways, we choose to, in whatever capacity, have faith in the sweet absolute, that the sweet absolute is all good. And that in relation with him, I am safe and I am secure. Yes. And next is naivete or innocence. And I think in Maharaj's book also, he has spoken about the concept of naivete. And this is a naturally occurring trait for a child, because the child is in a vulnerable state of being influenced, a vulnerable state of being teachable. So when this vulnerability is not exploited, then growing up, a person is able to learn to create new and empowering experiences, and even experiences which can be painful, and a person is able to learn lessons from that and continue moving forward. So the painful experiences does not hold back that person, or it does not disable them from individuating. Yes, so Nietzsche, he puts, I'll probably read the statement that he puts, he states, the child is innocence and forgetting, a new beginning, a sport, a self-propelling wheel, a sacred yes. So that sort of sums up the innocence or the naivete of a child. And we are also invited to, you know, have a healthy sense of innocence and naivete, allow ourselves to be influenced and transformed by what is to come in our devotional journeys. And then the next is dependence. Again, as human beings, we are not completely independent, and we are not totally dependent also. We are interdependent. So dependence refers to a sense of connection, establishing a relationship, relying on another person. And it is very essential for growth and having a lot of our relational needs met. So love and belongingness, safety, security, self-esteem, all of these are a part of relational needs. So a person who has a healthy sense of dependence. So when the child's dependence, let's say, was not dismissed, the parent was attending to the child when the child needed something from them, but at the same time also giving the child the space to explore safely, then the child develops a natural sense of trust growing up. Otherwise, and even as an adult, they are able to navigate flexibly between me time and we time. So they are able to establish secure relationships. But in the absence of that, in the absence of fostering a healthy dependence, what happens is it influences a child's nature to depend. So it influences the attachment styles. So how I connect with you. So I can connect with you in a secure manner, or I can be insecure in my relationships. So externally, it may seem as if I'm having fun, I'm enjoying your company. But then internally, there could be fear of abandonment, fear of rejection. Yes. Then next is emotional expression. So we see how children are quite uninhibited in either laughing or crying. Sometimes when they find something amusing, they giggle. And growing up, again, when these emotions are handled properly, when proper emotional coaching is provided by the parents, and when the child gets a sense that their emotions do matter, then what happens is, they're, as an adult, they're able to express their emotions in functional ways. So we have four basic emotions. So in transactional analysis, I mean, that's a therapy approach I'm getting trained in. So according to that, there are four basic emotions. So one is happiness, sadness, anger, and fear. So these are considered authentic, authentic feelings. So they are authentic when I experience, so there are certain instances which would evoke these emotions naturally. So for example, when my needs are met, then it's natural to feel happy. When I'm experiencing a loss, it could be a loss of a job, a loss of a relationship, a loss of a person, a loss of an experience. Probably I've lost my childhood. When I'm experiencing loss, it is natural to feel sad. When there is injustice happening, it's natural to feel angry. And when there is a threat, there is an active threat, then it is natural to experience fear. So each of these emotions have a role to enable us to problem solve. For example, when I'm feeling sad, what I'm doing is I am grieving the loss. And in the process of grieving the loss, I'm coming to terms with the reality of the loss, which is I'm reaching a stage of acceptance for me to be able to move on. Yeah. So when a child is shedding tears, or when they are laughing, or when they are smiling, it is necessary to coach them and validate those emotions. Otherwise, what happens is people may struggle expressing emotions. They may become numb, as a result of which they may not feel comfortable being vulnerable with another person. And not only may they become numb, so we'll see this in the emptiness part, in the branches part, we would see what I'm referring to, the numb or the apathy. And as a result of which, they may also become judgmental of others. So that's one of the outcomes of shame. So the very filters I'm judging myself with, I also use those same filters in judging another person. For example, if let's say there's a kirtan going on and everybody, and I am a person that cannot jump when the kirtan is loud and the mridanga is, you know, it's pumping up, you know, the energy is felt. So if let's say I am someone that's inhibited in expressing myself physically through dancing, then when somebody else besides me is jumping, I might secretly feel embarrassed, or I might feel cringed about how they are exhibiting. So now that sense of cringe or embarrassment is coming from my own filters. Yeah. Yes. And the next is resilience. Again, resilience is a very natural part of being a child. If you notice, when the child is learning to walk, in the beginning, they'll try crawling, they may fall down. And when they start standing up, they may fall down. And of course, the moments of falling down can be painful for the child. But then after a period of crying through pain, they again get up and they start walking. So resilience is a person's ability to bounce back in face of any distress. So the child has resilience and behavioral flexibility, which allows them to survive and grow. So that is essential for us in the here and now also, because we may as adults be confronted with multiple failures on micro levels or macro levels. What is important is our capacity to carry on amidst those failures. So resilience, this child-like natural trait, plays an important role in helping us carry forward amidst the difficulties. And the next is free play. Yes. So free play is a natural sense of playfulness, a natural sense of spontaneity or freedom. All of these are a part of free This requires leaps of imagination or thinking out of box, thinking differently, being unconventional, not the usual pattern. Sometimes when there is an invitation to step out of my comfort zone, to think or process something differently, unconventionally, that can be a part of playfulness. It requires creativity. And sometimes it's through such creative thinking you may discover many transformative things which are transformative, deeply transformative for me. And playfulness also comes in the context of making the process of living exciting and adventurous. So I remember once I was traveling, there was someone I was supposed to meet in the airport, and I somehow could not meet them. I missed the flight, and I missed meeting that person. They had already left the airport. I was grieving that in therapy session with my supervisor. And he just asked me, okay, so how did you reach the airport? So I was just saying that, I traveled by metro. And he was like, how was the experience of traveling in metro? And I told him it was fun. There is air conditioner, the metro is moving very fast. And then he was asking me that I can see that the outcome of your choice was not in your control, but then the process was in your control. So is it okay for you to experience joy in the process? Make your learning fun, so that playfulness is also necessary there. So the next quality is uniqueness. Again, every child, they have a innate sense of I amness. So it's quite innate. There is a sense of wholeness they have even as they are born. And this healthy sense of wholeness needs to be mirrored by the primary caregivers also. So the primary caregivers need to mirror to the child that the child matters to them. So mattering means that the child's specialness is reflected in the eyes of the caregiver. So mattering also refers to how much time the caregiver spends with the child, because children have this intuitive understanding that people give time to what they love. So if I am lovable, then my caregivers would spend time. And if not, then probably I'm not lovable. Yeah. And then the last is love. So the need to love, the need to be loved unconditionally, and the need to love, both are innate needs we as human beings have. So Montaigne is an artist who writes that of all purely human needs, the need to love is the most basic. It is a humanizing need. Beyond all others, it makes us human. So when I am loved unconditionally, it taps and it releases my own potential to love others. So when the child is shamed, when they are guilt-tripped, again, it may give them the impression that the love that they receive from caregivers is conditional. That is, they have to meet certain conditions in order to earn the love. As a result of which, that again inhibits their own capacity to seek love unconditionally and to provide love unconditionally. So I can only give what I have. So if what I've gotten as a child is conditional love, then that's the kind of love I would also be able to give. So yes, these are some of the impacts of shame. So now if you notice, if you look at these traits, you'll notice that all of these qualities, when we apply it with awareness, They actually play an important role in individuating and maximizing our own human potentials in bhakti. They help us lovingly and joyfully become cognizant of the Lord's omnipresence in context of eternity. That is Sat, Chit, and Ananda. It helps us tap into all three potentials when we process or heal through shame. And lack or distortion of the above qualities, it can make us misattuned with reality. I'm not in the here and now. It distorts my ability to be present in the present and connect with others with awareness. So hence, healing shame is one of the most important milestones in our own devotional journeys. Since healing this heals many other emotional baggages that we carry. Yes. Now, this is a reflection question. You can probably take a screenshot if you want. So, how would these qualities listed above affect you in your personal bhakti projects? So, you can take a moment and reflect on whatever qualities we have processed now. See how you can integrate them in your own bhakti project. You can just take a moment to think about it. And then we'll proceed to the last section.
Anupam, can you go back one slide?
Yes.
Thank you, Prabhu.
Oops. Yeah. So we can probably go to the last section, which is the outcomes of toxic shame. Again, you can sit with those reflection questions anytime. Yeah, so we still have some part to cover. So probably I'll cover. And after this also, there are a couple of reflection questions. Yes. So next topic is outcomes of toxic shame. Now, shame is a very powerful emotion. It's so powerful that it may make one want to voluntarily take one's own life. And even Krishna hints at this in Bhagavad Gita. So from verses 2.34 to 3.6. So I'll read the translation of that verse. So people will always speak of your infamy, and for a respectable person, dishonor is worse than death. The great generals who have highly esteemed your name and fame will think that you have left the battlefield out of fear only, and thus they'll consider you insignificant. Your enemies will describe you in many unkind words and scorn your ability. What could be more painful for you? So the Lord is hinting at the loss of dignity here. As a warrior, what could be more painful for Arjuna? Yes. And there is another instance of shame that we see in Srimad Bhagavatam. Again, there are multiple instances of shame, and I've just picked a few of them. So, in context of taking away one's own life, we do see in fourth canto how Sati Devi, the wife of Lord Shiva, when she's faced with the humiliation by her father Daksha, so Daksha neglects her when he's performing a particular sacrifice. She visits him, he neglects her, and he also neglects her husband. So in the sacrificial offerings, he ignores offering any oblations to her husband, Lord Shiva. And as a result of which, Sati feels very humiliated. She's embarrassed. She feels insulted by the entire experience. And as a result of it, she chooses to take her own life in that arena. So there are a lot of examples of toxic shame. So I'll probably just name a few. So Daksha verbally humiliating Lord Shiva. So he humiliates Lord Shiva because Lord Shiva doesn't get up when all other devatas and other saints in the assembly wake up get up to welcome Daksha. But Shiva is seated, And Daksha feels very humiliated by that act. So he starts, in turn insulting Lord Shiva. And again, there is an example of Karna becoming codependent on Duryodhana because he sees Duryodhana as the only ray of hope who has been saving him from being humiliated in multiple instances. But we see how Duryodhana was quite clever and tactic. He was exploiting Karna's skills so that he could be a useful instrument against Pandavas. So we see the patterns of codependence on Duryodhana. Then we also see Durvasa Muni cursing Ambarish because he feels personally humiliated by the act of Ambarish Maharaj breaking his fast with just water. In one sense, breaking fast with water is especially when you've not when you've fasted nirjal, it's sort of both. It's also considered breaking fast, but it is not exactly breaking fast as well. So Ambarish Maharaj did it out of respect and consideration for Durvasa Muni, but then because he was feeling so deeply humiliated by that, that shame sort of blocked his vision of seeing things for what they are. He could not appreciate Ambarish Maharaj's sentiments behind the act of breaking the fast with water. So that leads us to the next acronym, which Bradshaw uses. So he uses the term contaminate, and I think we are quite familiar with this term even in our own glossary. So shame, yes, so shame contaminates our own sense of perceiving reality, and there are different ways in which it contaminates. So it branches out in different ways, and some of these we may not even know have its roots in shame. So, first is codependence. So, again, codependence is where a person feels that their self-worth depends on how others feel about themselves. So, they can engage in validation-seeking behaviors. They depend on something outside of themselves to have a sense of identity. So, they do not know where I end and where you begin. So I identify with your views and your opinions and your judgments of me. And as a result of which, they may use the toxic ways of pleasing others. It becomes toxic in the sense, I'm pleasing you because I'm looking forward to seeking validation from you. So codependence is one of the outcomes of shame. Next is offender behavior. So offender behaviors refers to engaging in any form of violence or abusive actions. That is, the victim becomes the persecutor. So if we see in the history of mankind, we are all familiar with Hitler. So if you look at Hitler's childhood, he was chronically beaten, humiliated, toxically shamed by his father, who's also sadistic. And his father was an illegitimate son of a Jewish lord. So we see how Hitler recreated childhood tragedy in a global level, and he created one of the greatest tragic, gruesome history known to mankind, where millions of innocent people, lost their lives to extreme forms of cruelty. So a lot of times they also say that, sexual abusers would have been sexually abused as children themselves, especially child sexual abusers, by which we are not justifying any of their actions. We are implying what explains these behaviors, why these behaviors are happening. Yes. Next is narcissism. So narcissistic traits can also be developed when there is a distorted sense of mirroring. That is, when the parents of the children are judgmental and they mirror the child, probably overly mirroring the child. when they achieve something or when they do something, accomplish something, then at that point, what happens is the child may develop an unhealthy sense of entitlement, and they may engage in manipulative ways of seeking and validating their own self-worth. So it may seem as if they are very proud, but then the pride is actually a cover-up emotion to hide their internalized shame and feelings of worthlessness. Now, so this pride is more or less a false sense of grandiosity, because deep within, even if that person is an adult, deep within that facade of grandiosity, there is a child who's terrified, who's afraid of, you know, ceasing to exist if they are not special or unique. Yeah. And next is trust issues. Yes. So as we had seen in the section of optimism, they perceive others or world as unpredictable, as dangerous, as hostile. Therefore, they're always on guard. You may notice some people are always on guard. They try to control everything around them. If they don't have everything figured out, then you may see them becoming very anxious, worked up. So their belief is that if I control everything, no one can catch me off guard and hurt me. Yeah. So control madness can cause severe relationship problems. And there is no way I can be intimate with someone whom I don't trust. Yeah. And intimacy demands that, you know, you accept the other person the way they are and not take a position of holier than thou mindset. You know, so sometimes in the control madness, people can take this position, which is unhealthy in relationships. So trust issues is another outcome of shame. Next is acting out or acting in. So acting out is a reenactment where I repeat the past behaviors. I may set up, I may abuse others, or I may unconsciously set up myself for abuse. So if you notice some people, they may have a pattern of being in relationships which would eventually turn abusive, and they would have to step out of those relationships. So if it's once or twice, that is fine. But if it is a pattern, then that could be an acting out of a childhood experience. Acting in is where a person is engaging in self-punishing forms of thinking, feeling, or behaving. So I might be highly critical of myself. So when we saw anger, when we saw guilt, so guilt is seen as anger towards self. So when guilt is in unmanageable levels, then it can be self-punishing. So I may say that, okay, because I've not done something well or I've underperformed, I'm going to starve or I'm going to stay awake the whole night. And you know, that's my way of punishing myself for not doing something right. So that is acting in. And next is magical beliefs. So magical beliefs is where a person thinks that certain words, gestures, behaviors can change reality. That is, if I meet the right man or right woman, that would solve all my problems. Or if I have money, I will be okay. Or if I try hard, the world will reward me. Waiting will bring wonderful results. So as a child, I may think that, you know, if I say certain words or certain gestures, it'll automatically bring about a change in reality, which is magic. But even as adults, we may engage in such magical beliefs where I feel that something outside of myself will automatically change something within me. Next is intimacy dysfunctions. It is quite similar to the trust issues that we saw. So people fear being intimate when they are experiencing toxic shame. So one of the reasons being they are in denial of their own imperfections, their own strengths and vulnerabilities, and as a result of which they fear being isolated, abandoned, or engulfed by that relationship. So it's like there is no sense of self. I'm not aware of myself. I'm denying aspects of myself. So if I don't know who I am, how am I going to share myself with another person? So where is the scope of intimacy? Yeah. So when I'm deeply ashamed of myself, it results in my capacity to be vulnerable and to show up, to self-disclose aspects of me to the other person. So John Bradshaw, he quotes this very beautifully. He says, "It is impossible to be intimate if you have no sense of self. How can you share yourself with another if you do not really know who you are? How can anyone know you if you do not know who you really are?" So, yes, that is intimacy dysfunctions. And sometimes what happens is it may seem like a false sense of intimacy, where in order to seek acceptance and belonging, I may become the yes man for the other person. Yeah. So it may seem as if I'm very close with them. I agree with everything that we say. There is so much compatibility. But then deep within, it's a false sense of trying to fit in, or rather a distorted way of trying to seek acceptance and belonging. Yes. The next is, okay, Bhakti Rasa, how much time do I have?
About 15 minutes, it will be 10:30.
15 minutes. Okay, cool. Yeah. Yes, and the next is non-disciplined behaviors. Yes. So non-disciplined behaviors, it has both extreme in it. So one person is either overly disciplined or the other person is being or undisciplined. So a person who's being undisciplined, they can procrastinate, they can delay gratification when needed. So I remember when I had an exam, I was sitting and watching another series back when I was in college. I was binge watching one series, but then the next day I was having an exam. So there are moments where it is necessary for us to delay gratification. But people who are struggling with shame struggle to set boundaries with themselves as well. So they struggle to set boundaries with others also and with themselves also. And then sometimes people can act impulsively without thinking, or they can engage in unhealthy rebellion. And on the other extreme, a person who's overly disciplined, they can either be rigid, they can be very obsessive, overly controlling, they can be people pleasing, or they can expect perfectionism from self and others. Yeah. Another behavioral outcome is addictive or compulsive behaviors. So addictions can be of any sort. So it can be use of substances, which are chemicals. It can be cognitive addictions. It can be emotional addictions. It can be behavioral addictions. Now, one of the reasons why addictions occur is it helps in bringing about mood alteration. So when I'm experiencing shame, it helps unconsciously, consciously or unconsciously, mitigate the experience of the pain of shame. So sometimes people can use addictions as a form of coping mechanism to deal with shame. Next is thought distortions. So shame can lead to different cognitive distortions, or rather twisted ways of processing reality. So all or nothing thinking is one form of thought distortion. Personalizing, somebody else's behavior. Like, for example, a person did not smile at me when I greeted them. So probably they are upset with me. So that's a form of personalizing. I'm attributing the cause of their actions to myself. Next could be catastrophizing, emotional reasoning. There are a list of cognitive distortions. If you're interested to know more about it, you can probably Google it with the heading cognitive distortions. So shame can lead to cognitive distortions. Yeah. It alters my way to perceive reality as it is, being present in the present. And the last thing is emptiness, which we had processed in the beginning, in the impact section of it. So emptiness refers to a sense of apathy or sometimes even depression arising from the abandonment of authentic self. So when my authentic self itself is rejected, then I may feel empty inside. I may feel like nothing. I may be so disconnected with myself and with people around. So that's the experience of numbness. Yeah. So they may feel that their life is so dull, it's meaningless, and they may not be able to understand why other people are so excited about life. Yeah. So this emptiness leads to loneliness, even when they are surrounded and appreciated by people. Because we are never really who we are never truly present, because I'm not allowing myself to be me. I am not being in the present. Yeah, so that accounts, or that could lead to emptiness. Now the last part, now the question may arise, is shame only unhealthy? Is there no healthy sense of shame? No. Shame and guilt is not completely dysfunctional. So knowledge of shame and guilt, it helps us be mindful and considerate of people. It helps us be considerate of people, situation, time in our social interactions. It helps us, you know, deal with the situation or interact with people in a situation appropriate manner, where we respect boundaries of others, where we take accountability for our own personal actions. Thus, it guides us towards self-correction, making amends, growing. Yeah. I remember again in this instance, when I was undergoing training, when I was a counseling intern, I remember one of my peers was making a presentation, and my supervisor was sitting along with us, and we were all watching. And at that point, that person who was taking the presentation said something that reminded me of something funny in the past. So I started giggling, but since I was sitting in a place where I wouldn't be so visible to the person who's presenting, I thought that I can let myself giggle. But then turns out that my supervisor observed me, and then non-verbally he gestured to me saying not to do that, because that's disrespectful of the person who's standing there taking the efforts to speak in front of an entire audience. So I was quite flustered when that happened. But that was necessary. That sense of shame or embarrassment was necessary for me to realize that I was being insensitive to the person who is speaking. Yeah. So there can be a healthy sense of shame. And when shame or guilt happens, there are also ways of dealing with it in healthy ways. Now, the two examples I could think of from the top of my head were examples, cases of Vibhishana and Vidura. We see how in both their cases, their own relatives, so in the case of Vibhishana, it was his brother, and in the case of Vidura, it was his nephew. You see how they were insulted and humiliated in front of, they were publicly insulted and humiliated. And obviously, there is a complete loss of dignity that both of them had experienced. However, they did not let shame engulf them, rather engulf or blind or disable them. Rather, they dealt with it by setting necessary boundaries. They recognized that they saw the situation for what it is. So they realized that the space was toxic, that though they words of another person that is not being well received. Having realized that, they recognized what is their need. So they stood by their own integrity and they walked away from that space and they found their own healing in something more meaningful to them, which was either service to the Lord or inquiring about the Lord in both their cases. So yes, there is a healthy sense of shame as well. And there's a healthy way of handling shame. So finally, the last section. So with this, we can end. Why are we processing shame in such detail? So this takes me to this particular section from the book Radical Personalism, which I found very relevant, and that also inspired me to, share a few insights on the topic of shame. So probably I'll read this part. Proactive devotion encourages this process by first advocating that we acknowledge whatever problem may need to be addressed. Then we try to understand the problem comprehensively, and only then do we try to solve it. We never rush to make a problem go away before exhaustively learning what it has to teach us within its various shades and nuances. Albert Einstein is reported to have said, if I had 1 hour to solve a problem, I would spend 55 minutes thinking about the problem and 5 minutes thinking about the solutions. He realized that solution lies within the grasp of the problem and that understanding the problem solves the problem almost in totality. Yes, so that was the basis. In scriptures, shame is not directly addressed as being the root cause of a particular problem, or it's not addressed as being dysfunctional. There is no direct reference to shame. However, given that in the recent times, shame and its shades, act patiently in a way that it becomes relevant to us on all levels, be it psychological, social, or spiritual. So that was the aim of this session. And on that note, I'll go to the next section, which is the reflection questions. With that, we are ending. So, first reflection question. When do I experience shame? That is, what are the situations or setups which triggers shame?
Tom, I'm not sure if you can hear me, but we have completely lost your audio.
I'm really very sorry. Actually, I had connected the laptop with the I had connected the charger, but I forgot to turn on the switch. So the battery turned off. Yeah. So I'll just share the last screen share. Yes. Yeah. So when do I experience shame? What forms of coping have helped me manage shame? So when I was confronted with shame in the past, or confronted with people's judgments, or any shame triggering situation, what helped me handle it? The next question is, in coping with shame, how all have I sabotaged? So, how all have I sabotaged myself in the process? Or how may ha have I sabotaged relationships or sabotaged opportunities? So, what did not work for me or what backfired? And then the last is, How might I handle these sabotages in sustainable and functional ways? So just sit with these reflections. The aim of these questions is to bring about specificity in becoming aware of specific aspects which are which are relevant to me. So once I recognize the dynamics of shame in my own context, then that will give me a sense of direction as to what can I do to cope with shame. Yeah, what needs to be done? So only when I have a good understanding of the problem would my solution be problem specific. Yeah, yes. So probably I'll end it here. Thank you. Last slide. Yes. So I'm not able to see much. So I'm sorry for exceeding the time. So, do we have time for questions, Bhaktirasa? I was just wondering.
Yes, we have a few moments,
Oh,
and
just a
before that
minute. I'm not
happens,
able to hear
I really
you.
want to. Okay.
Can
Can you
you
hear me
speak
now?
now?
Yes, can you?
Okay.
How about now? Can you hear me now?
What's wrong with my audio? Hello, hello. Can you hear? No.
I cannot hear you on the phone. Wait. Unmute yourself.
Oh, am I audible?
Yes, you're audible now. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So, one thing, first of all, thank you so much for such an informative presentation. And for me, in addition to what you've given, is again the importance of how being holistic matters. The way you made connections between childhood and adulthood and humanity and divinity and our emotions and our mind. I mean, such a holistic presentation that it really brought that home for me. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Bhaktirasa. That sounds validating.
Okay, so now we can open it up for a few moments of questions. And I'm not sure if you can do anything about it, Anatom, but there is an echo.
Are you able to hear the echo now? I guess so.
An echo chamber.
Is everybody else mute and one person speaks? Maybe that would help. Oh my goodness, I would love to say something. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, that stopped it. I don't hear it. That's kind of annoying. And we probably had an example of coping with shame right there. Like, how to successfully cope with things that happen that trigger us to feel vulnerable, less than. So I was thinking of, I use my breath a lot. We each need to have tools, right? Because those things they just come up. So how to not have to plummet into shame spiral when something goes wrong, when I make a mistake. That's a big one for me. So that was a perfect example. And you maintained your happiness and optimism and innocence. I love those examples you gave, of I'm going to read over them. I took notes, copious notes. But the optimism that there is goodness, that, and I think that's like my opinion, having faith, like that Krishna is in charge and he's full of love. And I don't have to worry or stress or suffer over things. I can just open up and remain hopeful and have faith, optimistic. They're all very relatable. And it's funny that I don't usually use the scriptures to, and I know it's very appropriate, to coordinate our emotions and our experience with theirs, but it's totally relatable. And I don't know why I don't do that more. I appreciated your examples a lot. It's very, very wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rasangi. Your words, your feedback means a lot.
And
Coming
I
from
can't.
someone experienced like you
No, I'm
with so
finding a
much
way,
wisdom,
and I'm finding ways to
feels very
use
encouraging.
with my own clients. I can see ways that I can use these, what you've taught us, with my own and myself, my family. Thank you so much.
Yeah, so if I'm understanding your question right, your question, Rasange, is that how do we cope with shame when, those triggers set off, and how do we not succumb to it and not let ourselves get engulfed by it? So the thing about shame is, if you had noticed, it is something that a person develops right from the stage of infancy. There is a potential for that. The samskaras pertaining to shame can be quite powerful. So there's no quick fix to shame. But then there can be certain things that you may do, which is like a journey, it's like a process. It can take some time because shame has been formed over a period of time. So for it to heal, also, it'll take it some time. So in the process of healing, what can help is specificity can help. So, which is why those were one of the goals for providing the reflection questions, to become specific about my areas, my triggers of shame that is unique to me, so that once I have a tangible awareness about the problem, I can identify areas that I can work on, so I'll be able to see tangible progress. Now, what is it that I can work on, or how I can sort of begin the process of healing through shame? One thing that comes to my mind is the concept of core beliefs. So, as children, I develop the concept about self, I develop concept about others, life or world at large, and all of these become unconscious. like I may not know that I'm living them in the here and now. I'm living the implications of those beliefs. So probably identifying those beliefs can be a starting point. So to identify, if you even refer online resources, you'll find multiple resources that will give you a list of, you know, core beliefs. So the core beliefs pertain to three areas. So it's about self, it's about others, and life or world at large. So there can be certain core beliefs in each of these areas that may trigger shame in me. So probably going through that list, identifying, for example, if I feel that I'm not good enough, or if as a child I've developed this belief that I am unlovable. Now all of these would, if I'm a part now in the here and now, if I am in a group interacting with people, I'll feel like the odd one out. I'll feel like everybody else is speaking with each other. They are all engaging in loving exchanges. And then there is me, you know. So I may feel that I don't belong here. Because from, I deep down believe that I'm unlovable. And because I believe that I'm unlovable, I would not allow myself to access love from another person. I wouldn't allow myself to seek love from the other. So identification, so these core beliefs are like the filters. So that can be a beginning point, identifying what are my core beliefs. Yeah, core beliefs pertaining to these three areas. And then gradually challenging these core beliefs. Are they relevant in the here and now? Is it true? Because I would have developed these core beliefs from an egocentric pattern of thinking. So egocentric is where I personalize unpleasant experiences. I as being the cause of all the unpleasant experiences around me. So as an adult, I may know that I'm not completely responsible for the unpleasant things that have happened to me or the abuses that I may have undergone. So with my adult awareness, I can put these core beliefs to test it against reality. Most of the times we will see that they are not valid.
Very cool.
And the principles of self-love, the principles of radical personalism, when you read through those principles, I would invite you to also see how shame can, you know, get in the way of integrating the different principles of radical personalism. And whatever you relate with so much in your learning of radical personalism, I would invite you to own it. Because what you relate with is very unique only to you. And once you own it, it becomes yours. And that is very crucial for healing. That is something even my supervisor would say, that, you know, when you are learning in the therapy technique that you're getting trained in, see what relates or what strikes with you personally, and then own that and become your own therapist, a version of yourself. So,
I love that. Thank you. And maybe there needs to be a part two to this.
Well,
to continue on.
I wanted to announce that. As a result of this, I think Nanutama is considering doing a month-long in-depth series, expanding what she has brought to us today. So we'll let you know when that happens. And I have a few announcements before we end for today. Do you feel complete, Anutam?
I can stay. Is that what you're asking? Can I stay for the announcements to me?
No, no. I'm wondering if you are complete, if you feel that you have, is there anything more you would like to say?
Actually, I'm sort of, every time I speak, I'm unmuting this device so that, you know, the echo doesn't come. So, yeah, I can. You can take over, Bhaktira sir. You can make the announcements. That's fine.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me here. And
Thank you.
thank
It
you
was
all for
beautiful.
staying.
Beautiful.
Very well.
Beautiful. So just quickly to let you all know of the time for the coming class on Tuesday, Swami Padmanabha's Evolution in Divine Love is changing until 9:30. It's 1/2 hour later than it originally was. So his continuing the course in Evolution in Divine Love will be Tuesday, as was planned, and the time will be 1/2 hour later. Then also later this month, there will be a Spanish class given by Swami Das on neurolinguistics, which he has been studying and sharing and teaching others. So I'm excited that our Spanish-speaking brothers and sisters will have access to this information. All right. Thank you all so much for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Thank you.